not hampering, we're helping.
I didn't notice either of you digging up a body, adds Ron to Chris and Donna.
We have certainly done an awful lot of the work so far, explains Ibrahim.
So this is how I see it, confirms Elizabeth. Either you arrest us, which we would all understand, and Joyce, in fact, I think would actually enjoy.
No comment, says Joyce, nodding happily.
Or you don't arrest us, and we can spend the rest of the evening talking about exactly why someone buried a body on this hillside sometime in the 1970s.
Chris looks at Donna.
And we can also discuss whether that same person has just murdered Ian Ventham to keep it secret, says Elizabeth.
Donna looks at Chris. Chris has a question.
So you think the same person might have committed two murders, but nearly 50 years apart?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Asks Elizabeth.
It's an interesting question we could have been asking last night, says Chris.
It might have been useful to know we could be looking for someone who was right here in the 1970s and is still right here now, adds Donna.
We really are sorry, says Joyce. But Elizabeth was adamant and, you know, Elizabeth.
Let's move on, says Elizabeth. Put this behind us.
Do we have a choice, Elizabeth? Asks Chris.
Choice is overrated.
You'll learn that as the years fly by, says Elizabeth.
Now, to business. What do you make of the priest, I wonder, Father Mackey? Might he have been around when this place was a convent?
I take it from that question that you haven't been able to find out anything about Father Mackey, says Chris.
Don't tell me I've found a chink in your armour.
My inquiries are ongoing, says Elizabeth.
No need, Elizabeth, we've cracked that one for you, says Donna. It's Dr. Mackey. Not a priest, never has been, never will be. A doctor in Ireland, moved over here in the 90s.
That's very curious, says Elizabeth.
Why pretend to be a priest?
Told you he was a wrong'un, says Ron to Ibrahim.
So he might have killed Ian Ventham, says Donna.
And he's certainly up to something, but I doubt it's because of your bones.
Is it worth my pointing out any more that this is all confidential? Says Chris.
You are quite safe with us. You know that, don't you? Nothing ever leaves this room, says Elizabeth. Shall we just forget this ever happened? The business with the bones and what have you, and pool our knowledge?
I think we've pooled quite enough for one day, Elizabeth, says Donna.
Oh, really? Says Elizabeth. And yet you haven't even told us about the Tony Curran photograph yet. We had to find that out for ourselves.
Donna and Chris both look at Elizabeth. Chris lets out a theatrical sigh.
By way of a peace offering, says Ibrahim. Perhaps you would like to know who took the photograph?
Chris looks up to the heavens, or Joyce's Artex ceiling.
I would actually like to know that, yes.
Lad named Turkish Gianni, says Ron.
Although he's not Turkish, adds Joyce.
You've seen the photo, Ron? Asks Donna. Ron nods.
Nice one of Jason, eh?
You want my view for what it's worth, says Ron. You find Turkish Gianni or Bobby Tanner, you find Tony Curran's killer.
Well then, if we're laying all our cards on the table, says Chris, has Jason explained away his phone calls to Tony Curran on the morning of the murder? And has he explained away the presence of his car in the area at the exact moment that Tony Curran was murdered?
Yes, says Elizabeth, to our satisfaction.
Anything you'd like to share? Asked Donna.
Listen, I'll get him to give you a bell and explain, don't worry, says Ron.
But shall we get on and find this Gianni fella and Bobby Tanner? Just leave that with us, please, says Chris. I think we're unlikely to just leave that with you, Chris, says Elizabeth. I'm ever so sorry. Would you like some sherry? Asks Joyce. It's only Sainsbury's, but it tastes the difference. Chris sinks back into his chair and submits. If any of this ever gets back to my superintendent, I will personally arrest you and march you into court myself. I swear on my life. Chris, no one will ever find out, says Elizabeth. You know how I used to make my living. Well, not really, if I'm honest. Exactly. As a complicit silence falls over the room, it seems the evening's drinking can now begin in earnest. I am very proud of how we all work together as a team, says Ibrahim. Cheers. Chapter 77. Joyce. I'm glad we told Chris and Donna about the bones. It seems right. Now everyone can keep an eye out. Who was here in the 1970s and is still here today? That should keep them all occupied for a bit. Everyone knows everything now, and that seems fair. So, where are Gianni and Bobby? Now we've dealt with the bones, I know Elizabeth will be thinking about how we track them down. That's right up her street, isn't it? I will get a call in the morning and it will be, Joyce, we're going to Reading, or Joyce, we're going to Inverness or Timbuktu. And bit by bit she'll tell me why, and before you know it, we'll be having a cup of tea with Bobby Tanner or a cafe au lait with Turkish Gianni. You wait and see. Tomorrow morning, before 10 a.m. Guaranteed. The only time I ever use my passport is when I need to pick up a parcel, but I've just checked and it has 3 years left. I remember when I first got it wondering if it would be my last ever. The odds on it being renewed are with me now, I think. Anyway, that's just to say that if Gianni or Bobby Tanner are abroad somewhere, then I wouldn't put it past Elizabeth to hop on a plane. We're only a drive from Gatwick here. I could send Joanna a postcard. Who, me? Oh, I'm in Cyprus for a couple of days, tracking down a fugitive, possibly armed, but you mustn't worry. Though no one sends postcards anymore, do they? Joanna has shown me how to send photos on my phone, but I'm beggared if it's ever worked when I tried. I just get that spinning circle. Perhaps I could ask Bernard to come along with me. A couple of days in the sun. Last-minute thing, we just fancied it. I think it might frighten the poor man to death. I don't like to give up on a chase, but Bernard seems to be drifting further and further away from me. He wasn't a bundle of fun at lunch, and there was plenty of steak and kidney left over. And don't think I don't know what the others think, what they suspect. They'll be checking whether Bernard was here 50 years ago. They haven't spoken to me about it, but you mark my words. Check away, don't mind me. Timbuktu is a real place, by the way. Did you know that? It came up in a quiz. Ibrahim will remember where it is. But I did think that was interesting. Chapter 78. Chris Hudson is cradling a whiskey. He likes a real log fire, and they have a nice one at Le Pont Noir. He's never eaten here, because who would he eat with? But he likes the bar. The fire has a vintage tile surround, very tasteful. If you'd asked him 20 years ago, he would have imagined this was the sort of place he might live. Leather armchair, whiskey on the go, wife reading some sort of book opposite him. Something prize-winning and beyond him, but she'd be turning the pages, smiling wryly. A love story set against the backdrop of the Raj. He could be looking at murder case notes, slowly solving something. He is still sure that Mackie is guilty as hell. It added up. But these bones, did they change things? Had there been two murders 50-odd years apart, one to protect the other? If so, then Mackie wasn't their man. They've been through the records. He hadn't left Ireland until the 90s. His mind drifts back to his dream life. Were there kids sleeping upstairs? In new pajamas? A boy and a girl 2 years apart, good sleepers? But no, none of that. Just a fireplace in a bar that wasn't doing enough business. In a restaurant that he had no one to take to. Then a walk home, stop at the all-night shop for a dairy milk. A proper big one. Then the key fob, the apartment block, the three flights up, the flat that the cleaner kept clean, that no one ever cooked in, the spare room that was never used. If he opened his window, he could hear the sea, but couldn't see it. Didn't that just sum it up? There was a life that Chris hadn't been able to take in his grasp. Families, driveways, trampolines, friends round for dinner, all the stuff you'd see on adverts. Was this forever now? The lonely flat with the neutral walls and the Sky Sports. Maybe there was a way out, but Chris couldn't immediately spot it. Treading water, getting fatter, laughing less. Chris was out of rocket fuel. It was lucky that Chris loved his job, was good at his job. Chris always found it easy to get up in the morning. He just found it hard to go to sleep at night. Leave Mackie B for a minute and focus on Tony Curran's murder. Jason Ritchie had rung him earlier, told his tale, explained away the calls and the car. If he was lying, then he'd done a good job of it. But then he would, wouldn't he? Bobby Tanner was still proving elusive. After Amsterdam, there was no more Bobby Tanner on any official record. But he'd be somewhere. Maybe Brussels, living under some name or other. Plenty of gangs could use him out there. He'd be doing what he'd always done, smuggling, fighting, making himself useful. Not a big enough fish for anyone to worry about. Burned often enough to be careful. They'd catch him coming out of some expat gym one day, put their hand on his shoulder and fly him back for a few questions. Though, of course, there was a good chance that Bobby Tanner was dead too. Steroids, pub fight, fell off a ferry, so many ways to go, and the only way to identify him, a false passport. But Chris thinks Bobby is still out there somewhere. And if he's still out there somewhere, then who's to say he hasn't just paid a visit to Tony Curran for some long-forgotten reason? Something to do with his brother drowning with that boat full of drugs. Who knew? And then the new name. Turkish Gianni. Chris had found plenty on record for him. Gianni Gunduz was his real name. Fled the country in the early 2000s after a tip-off he'd murdered the cabbie in the Blackbridge shooting. Everything kept coming back to that one night in this very bar. Had Gianni come back to town? Chris finishes his whiskey and looks at the tiles once again. Beautiful, really. He should probably go home. Chapter 79. Joyce. Just two quick things this morning as I find myself in a hurry. Firstly, Timbuktu is in Mali. I bumped into Ibrahim on my way back from the postbox and I asked him. I also saw Bernard walking slowly up the hill. It's every day now, but never mind. And, as I say, Mali. So now you know. Secondly, Elizabeth rang at 9:17 and we're off to Folkestone. From the looks of it, it's two changes, one at St. Leonard's and one at Ashford International, so we're setting off nice and early. I haven't been to Ashford International, but I doubt a station would have International in its name and not have an M&S. Maybe even an Oliver Bonas. Fingers crossed. I promise I will report back later. Chapter 80. In many ways, his neighbours owed Peter Ward a debt of thanks, and, to be fair, most of them knew it. Pearson Street had always been a little down at heel. A newsagent with no papers, a mini-mart with a mountain of cheap alcohol behind the counter, a travel agent with fading posters of the Sun, two bookies, a pub on its last legs, a party accessories shop, a nail bar, and a boarded-up cafe. And then the flour mill had moved in. Peter Ward's shop, bursting with colour, a little rainbow explosion on this grey street. And what flowers? Peter Ward knew his stuff. And when you know your stuff in a small town, word soon gets around. People would start making detours from the town centre and they would tell their friends, who would tell their friends, and before you know it, someone down from London has spotted the boarded-up cafe and bought the lease, and now there were two reasons to visit Pearson Street. Then, a bride ordering flowers from Peter and enjoying a latte in the cafe sees this little street is on the up and wonders if it might be the place to open a small hardware store. So now the tool chest sits next to the flour mill opposite Casa Cafe. The travel agent suddenly has people walking past, feels the need to change those posters, and those people start walking in. Under 30s mainly, who have no idea what a travel agent might be. The Londoner with the cafe buys the pub and starts doing food. Terry at the newsagent starts ordering in more papers, more milk, more everything. The nail bar paints more nails, the party shop sells more balloons, the mini-mart starts stocking gin alongside the vodka. John from the butcher's counter at Asda takes the leap and opens a store of his own, taking his customers with him. A local art group hires out a vacant storefront and takes it in turns to buy pieces of each other's art, all thanks to Peter Ward's orchids and sweet peas and Transvaal daisies. Pearson Street is just what you want a shopping street to be. Busy, friendly, local and happy. Joyce thinks it's so perfect that it's surely only 6 months away from having a Costa and losing what it now has, which would be sad, but Joyce has to admit that she likes a Costa, so must shoulder some of the blame. Joyce and Elizabeth are sitting in Casa Cafe. Peter Ward has just bought them both a cappuccino. Becky from the tool chest will keep an eye out for customers while he takes half an hour off. It's that sort of street. Peter Ward is greying and smiling and has the easy air of a man who has made a series of good decisions in life. A Folkestone florist, whom karma has rewarded for a lifetime of kindness and calmness. A man whose good deeds have delivered him the prize of happiness. This impression is misleading. As the scar under his right eye and the bulge of the biceps will tell you, Peter Ward is Bobby Tanner. Or perhaps Peter Ward has left Bobby Tanner behind. That is what they have come to find out. Is the fighter still there? The killer, perhaps. Has he recently made the short trip along the coast to Fairhaven and bludgeoned to death his former boss? Elizabeth lays the photograph on the table between them and Peter Ward picks it up, smiling. The Black Bridge, says Peter. We had a few nights in there. Where'd you get this from? A number of places, says Elizabeth. Well, two places, in fact. One was sent to Jason Ritchie and one was found by the corpse of Tony Curran.
I read about Tony, nods Peter Ward. That was about time.
You've never seen this photograph before? Asks Elizabeth. Peter looks again, then says,
never have.
You weren't sent one, asks Joyce, and sips her cappuccino. Peter shakes his head. Well, that's either good news for you or it's good news for us, says Elizabeth. Peter Ward raises an inquiring eyebrow. Well, it's either good news for you in that Tony Curran's killer has no idea where you are, or it's good news for us in that you killed Tony Curran yourself and we haven't wasted a trip to Folkestone.
Peter Ward gives a half smile and looks at the photo again.
Not that the trip would really be wasted, says Joyce. We're having a very nice day.
The police have the idea that Jason killed Tony Curran, starts Elizabeth. And perhaps he did, but for reasons of our own, we would prefer that he didn't. Would you have a view on that, Bobby?
Peter Ward holds up a hand. Peter, around here, please.
Would you have a view on that, Peter? Asks Elizabeth.
I don't see it, says Peter Ward. Jason went nowhere near that side of things. He looks mean, but he's a teddy bear.
Joyce looks up from her notes for a moment.
A teddy bear who funded a major drugs ring?
Peter acknowledges this with a nod.
Elizabeth puts the photo back down on the table. So, if not Jason, then perhaps you. Or perhaps Turkish Gianni.
Turkish Gianni? Says Peter.
He took the photo.
Peter Ward thinks for a while.
Did he now? I don't remember, but that would make sense.
I'm guessing you know the story. The boy Tony shot in the Black Bridge. Gianni shooting the taxi driver who got rid of the body.
We know that story, yes, confirms Elizabeth. Then Gianni disappears back to Cyprus.
Well, it wasn't quite that simple, says Peter Ward.
I'm all ears, says Elizabeth.
Someone grasped Gianni up to the cops. They raided his flat, but he'd already gone.
And who grasped him up? Asks Elizabeth.
Who knows?
Not me.
No one likes a grass, says Joyce.
It doesn't matter who, says Peter Ward. What matters is that when Gianni legged it, he took $100,000 of Tony's cash with him.
Is that so?
Money he had lying around his flat, Tony's money, all disappeared.
Tony went mental. $100,000 was a lot of money to Tony in those days.
Did he try and find Gianni? Asks Elizabeth.
You bet. Went off to Cyprus a couple of times, didn't find a thing.
Not easy when it's not your natural territory, says Elizabeth.
So I'm guessing you haven't found Gianni either, asks Peter Ward. Elizabeth shakes her head.
How did you find me, by the way? He goes on. If you don't mind me asking, I don't really want to be found by anyone if Gianni's back in town, leaving photos of me next to bodies.
Elizabeth takes a sip of her coffee.
Woodvale Cemetery, where they buried your brother Troy?
Peter Ward nods.
I got access to the CCTV, thanks to a mortician whose uncle I once saved on a train, says Elizabeth. That's where I found you.
Peter Ward looks at Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, I've been there twice in a year. There's no way you found me from the CCTV. That'd be a needle in a haystack.
You went there twice, yes, agrees Elizabeth.
But on what days?
Peter Ward sits back, folds his arms, then nods and smiles. He sees it now.
12th of March and 17th of September, continues Elizabeth. Troy's birthday and the anniversary of his death.
I was hoping to see the same car both times, jot down a number plate, get the friend of a friend to run it through a computer somewhere, but on March the 12th, I saw a white van from a Folkestone flower shop, which I thought unusual at a cemetery in Brighton, not impossible, but noteworthy. And I thought it very, very unusual to see the same van on September the 17th. I found that very noteworthy indeed.
You see?
I do,
see, nods Peter Ward. And no need for a number plate.
Because you had your name, your address and your telephone number sign written on the side, says Elizabeth.
Peter can't help but give Elizabeth a quiet round of applause and she responds with a slight bow.
That's very good, Elizabeth, says Joyce. She's very good, Peter.
I see that, says Peter. So no one else knows where I am. No one else can find me.
Not unless I tell them where you are, says Elizabeth.
Peter Ward leans forward. And is that something you'd be likely to do? Elizabeth leans forward too.
Not if you come and see us tomorrow, sit down with Jason and the police and tell them what you just told us.
Chapter 81.
Would you like a walnut? Asks Ibrahim.
Bernard Cottle looks at him and then down at the open bag of walnuts he is being offered.
No, thank you.
Ibrahim withdraws the bag.
Very low-carb walnuts, in moderation. Nuts are very healthy, but not cashews. Cashews are an exception.
Am I disturbing you, Bernard?
No, no, says Bernard.
Just enjoying the view? Asks Ibrahim. He can sense that Bernard feels uncomfortable sharing his bench.
Just taking the weight off, says Bernard.
What a place to be buried, says Ibrahim. Wouldn't you think?
If one has to be buried, says Bernard.
Sadly, it comes to the best of us, doesn't it? However many walnuts we might eat.
I mean no offence by this, but I'm very happy to sit in silence, says Bernard.
That's not unreasonable, says Ibrahim, nodding. He eats a piece of walnut.
The two men sit, taking in the view. Ibrahim turns and sees Ron walking up the path, trying to hide his limp. He has a stick, but he won't use it.
Well, this is nice, says Ibrahim. Here comes Ron.
Bernard looks. There is the slightest pursing of the lips. Ron reaches the bench. He sits the other side of Bernard.
Afternoon, gents, says Ron.
Good afternoon, Ron, says Ibrahim.
So, Bernard, old son, says Ron, you keeping guard?
Bernard looks at Ron.
Keeping guard?
Of the graveyard. Sitting here like a gnome. None shall pass, all that. What's up?
Bernard wants to be left in silence, Ron, says Ibrahim. That's what he tells me.
Fat chance of that with me around, says Ron.
So come on, May, what are you hiding up here?
Hiding, says Bernard.
I don't buy all this grief stuff, son. We all miss our wives with the greatest respect. Something else is going on here.
I think grief affects people in different ways, Ron, says Ibrahim. Bernard's behaviour is not unusual.
I don't know, Ib, says Ron, shaking his head and looking out over the hills. Geezer gets killed the other day when all he wanted to do was dig up the graveyard. Bernard sits here by that same graveyard all day, every day. That changes things for me.
Is that what's happening here? Asked Bernard, voice calm and level, refusing to look at Ron. You're talking to me about the murder?
That's what's happening, Bernard, yeah, says Ron. Someone down there injected the guy and killed him. We all had our hands on him, remember? Any one of us could have done it.
We simply need to eliminate some people from our inquiries, says Ibrahim.
Maybe you had a good reason, says Ron.
Is there ever a good reason to murder someone, Ron? Asks Bernard.
Ron shrugs. Maybe you've got something hidden up there in the graveyard. You are diabetic. Could be the needle.
We all are, Ron, says Bernard.
Where were you in the 70s, mate? Were you local?
That's a peculiar question, Ron, says Bernard, if you don't mind me saying.
All the same, were you? Says Ron.
We're just exploring avenues, says Ibrahim. We're asking everyone.
Bernard turns to Ibrahim.
Is this the game? Good cop, nasty cop?
Ibrahim considers this.
Well, yes, that is the idea. Psychologically, it is often very effective. I have a book you could read if you were interested.
Bernard lets out a long breath and turns to Ron.
Ron, you met my wife? You met Asima?
Ron nods.
And you were nothing but kind to her. She liked you.
Well, I liked her, Bernard. You had a good one there.
Everyone liked her, Ron, says Bernard. And yet you still ask me why I sit here.
It's nothing to do with the graveyard, and it's nothing to do with the needles or where I lived 50 years ago. It's just an old man who misses his wife. So spare me.
Bernard stands.
Gentlemen, you have spoiled my morning. Shame on you both.
Ibrahim looks up at Bernard.
Bernard, I don't believe you, I'm afraid. I want to, but I don't. You have a story you are desperate to tell. So, any time you want to talk, you know where to find me.
Bernard smiles and shakes his head.
Talk. To you?
Ibrahim nods.
Yes. Talk to me, Bernard. Or to Ron. Whatever has happened, the worst thing you could do is stay silent.
Bernard tucks his paper under his arm.
With respect, Ibrahim, Ron. You have no idea what the worst thing I could do is.
And with that, Bernard starts a slow walk down the hill.
Chapter 82. Joyce.
Well, that was jolly good fun. For starters, I had never been to Folkestone. Peter Ward is Bobby Tanner's name now, but we are sworn to secrecy. He owns a florist. I suppose I have two things to write about then. Why was Peter Ward a florist, and florist or not, who did he think killed Tony Curran? I might write about Bernard too, but I will leave that to the end because I want to think about it while I write the rest. Peter Ward, I will call him Peter, left Fairhaven shortly after his brother died for reasons you can imagine. He got himself a new passport. It's easily done if you listen to Elizabeth and Peter, but I wouldn't know how to go about it, would you? He ended up in Amsterdam doing odd jobs, not odd jobs as we would think about them, like clearing your gutters or painting your fence, but taking cocaine across the channel on ferries. Or, I suppose, threatening people. You could see that in him, underneath everything. He fell in with a gang from Liverpool. He wouldn't tell us the name, as if I would have any sway if he had. Their ruse was to smuggle drugs in the backs of those big flour lorries you see coming over from Holland and Belgium. That was their angle. At first, Peter would do the loading. A driver would be paid such and such to stop his lorry in a lay-by in Belgium, and Peter and a few cronies would hop in the back and stash what they could where they could. Over the lorry would go, another stop in Kent, and Bob's your uncle. These lorries were back and forth all the time. It's a daily schedule, isn't it? Has to be because of fresh flowers. So it was perfect. They just had the odd driver here and there, and that's how it worked at first, until the penny dropped and they bought one of the nurseries. The business ran as usual, but Peter was on hand to inspect every shipment as it went out and to add that little special something to each one. So now they had three lorries a day travelling through Zeebrugge, and they could do what
they liked with them. Clever, really. Peter would spend all his time at the nursery, and the young lad who ran it was paid to turn a blind eye. They'd play cards and chat and whatever else you do all day in Belgium. Off subject for a minute, but there was a notice pinned up the other day about a trip to Bruges, and I thought of signing up. Joanna went a few years ago, and her verdict was, "It's too twee, Mum, but you would love it." So I might take the plunge. Would Elizabeth like it? That's by the by, because here's what happened next. There was an error. No one knows how or why, or at least Peter doesn't, but the upshot was that a small florist's shop in Gillingham accidentally took delivery of 2 kilograms of cocaine alongside their begonias and promptly reported it to the police. The police, who are no fools at times, didn't rush straight in and arrest the driver. They followed him instead and saw where he headed and what was what. There was a whole team on it eventually, and one by one they worked out who was doing what and arrested everyone they could. The way Peter told it, he and the young lad running the nursery had seen the police coming a mile off. "Belgium is as flat as Holland," says Peter, "and they hid in a field of sunflowers for 6 hours as the police stripped the place bare." In Amsterdam, one of the Liverpudlians was killed by a Serbian shortly afterwards, and that was that. You can see where it's going, I'm sure. Peter had never really risen through the ranks. He wasn't really the type, but he'd made a bit of money, and he had learned an awful lot about flowers. And he saw them at their most beautiful, of course. He described the colours and so on and got quite lyrical. Elizabeth had to hurry him along eventually. So, now every day one of those big lorries pulls up in Pearson Street and Peter gets in the back, like he always used to. But this time he just unloads his flowers and carries them into his shop. And the lorry continues on its rounds and heads back to Belgium, to the nursery run by the young lad he'd played cards with and hidden in a sunflower field with. So that's a nice story. I bet the Liverpudlians and the Serbians are still shooting each other left, right and centre in Amsterdam, but Peter has his beautiful shop in that lovely street where everybody knows his name. Or doesn't know his name, but you take my point. And the benefit of going straight was that no one has ever come looking for him. No one has ever arrested him and taken a closer look at that passport, so Peter Ward had left his past behind and found some peace. Which is not easy to do. Just to satisfy Elizabeth's curiosity, Peter took her to the flour mill and showed her the CCTV from the day Tony Curran was murdered. There he was, Peter, I mean, plain to see behind the till. Which, I think, rules him out. He is sure that Turkish Gianni is our man. Tony had betrayed him to the police and Gianni had stolen from Tony in turn. That would do it, I suppose. Elizabeth and I talked about it on the train and we had half an hour at Ashford International where, believe it or not, there are no shops. Perhaps there are shops beyond passport control. There must be, surely. So, that's Bobby Tanner. Time for bed, Joyce. I wonder what Ron and Ibrahim were up to today. I know I was going to say something about Bernard, but it hasn't really formulated, so I won't. I bought Bernard some freesias from Peter Ward's shop. I wanted to buy something, but I couldn't think who to buy them for, and I thought perhaps Bernard would like them. Do women give men flowers? Not where I'm from, but perhaps that's not where I am anymore. So they're in the sink, and I will take them over tomorrow morning. Bernard would like Bruges, don't you think? Chapter 83. The path is uneven, but by shining a torch at the ground, he is able to make his way up to the allotments without drawing attention to himself.
It is late, and everyone will be asleep, but why take the risk? He reaches the shed. There is a padlock, but it's a cheap one, and his wife's hat pin soon springs it open. The shed is shared by all the residents who have an allotment at Cooper's Chase, a select band. There are a couple of folding chairs for nice weather, and there's a kettle for colder weather. There are bags of fertilizer and mulch along one wall. These are bought from the kitty, and Carlito carries them in whenever the minibus comes back from the garden centre. Pinned above the fertiliser are the rules of the Cooper's Chase Allotment Users Association. They are lengthy and they are enforced with vigour. It is cold, even on a summer's night. The torch continues its circuit. There are no windows, which makes it easier. The spade rests against the back wall inside the shed. One look tells him all he needs to know. All he already knew, if he was honest as he walked up the path. But what to do? You have to try. He lifts it by the handle, but is quickly beaten by its weight. When did he get so weak? What happened to his body? It was never much to write home about, but to think he could now barely lift a spade. Digging was out of the question. So what now? Who could help? Who would understand? It was hopeless. Bernard Cottle sits in a folding chair and weeps for what he has done. Chapter 84. Chris and Donna are sitting in the jigsaw room with mugs of tea. Opposite them are Jason Ritchie and Bobby Tanner. Bobby Tanner, whom detectives across 8 forces had failed to locate. Elizabeth has repeatedly refused to say where or how she found him. Elizabeth and Joyce have both seen evidence that Bobby was busy elsewhere when Tony Curran was murdered. Chris had wondered if he might see that evidence, and Elizabeth had told him he certainly could the moment he produced a warrant. Bobby's deal was that he would tell them everything he knew and then slip back into the crowd, never to be seen again. $100,000. Bit more than that, says Bobby Tanner. Gianni had it at his flat, used to keep it safe for Tony. Did he have a nice flat? Asks Joyce. One of the big ones on the front, says Bobby. Oh, yes, with the picture windows, says Joyce. Lovely. And Tony went out to Cyprus looking for him, asks Chris. A couple of times, yeah, never found a thing. Nothing was the same after that. Jason, you drifted off, didn't you? Started doing telly and all that? Jason nods. It wasn't for me anymore, Bobby. Bobby nods. I left town a couple of months after, when my brother died. Nothing left for me here then. But someone would have seen Gianni, surely, asked Donna. If he'd come back to town recently, someone would have seen him, someone would be talking. Bobby thinks about this. Not too many faces left from those days. Hard to know who Gianni would turn to if he needed a place to stay, says Jason. Bobby looks at Jason. Unless, Jace. Jason looks back at Bobby, thinks for a moment, then nods. Of course. Of course, unless, Jason starts composing a text. Are you going to share this with the group? Asks Elizabeth. Just someone me and Bobby need to talk to, says Jason. Someone who'd know for sure. Leave it with us. It's not fair if you get to solve everything, Elizabeth. Perhaps you could share it with the police, suggests Donna. Oh, come on, says Bobby, laughing. Worth a try, says Donna. Jason's phone pings. He looks down, then turns to Bobby. He can meet us at 2. That okay for you?
Bobby nods and Jason starts another message. Only one place for it, eh?
Chapter 85. Lunch at Le Pont Noir. Just like old times, and yet, of course, not like them at all.
Astronaut, guesses Jason Ritchie.
Bobby Tanner smiles and shakes his head.
Jockey,
guesses Jason. Bobby Tanner shakes his head again.
I ain't gonna tell you, even if you guess.
Fair enough, fair enough.
You happy though, Bobby?
Asks Jason. Bobby nods his head. Good lad, says Jason.
You deserve it.
We both do, agrees Bobby Tanner, one way or another.
Well, we do and we don't, says Jason.
Bobby Tanner nods. Maybe so.
They are on desserts, still waiting for their guest, and a bottle of Le Pont Noir's finest Malbec has been dispatched.
I mean, it must have been Gianni, right?
Asks Bobby.
I've always thought he was dead somewhere.
I've always thought that you were dead somewhere, says Jason. I'm glad you're not, though.
Thanks, Jace, says Bobby.
Jason looks at his watch.
We'll know for sure soon enough.
You reckon he'll know? Asks Bobby.
If Gianni's been over, then he'll know. That's where he'd have stayed.
I can't do lunchtime drinking anymore, can you? Asks Bobby.
We're old men now, Bob, agrees Jason. Time for another bottle, though.
They agree that they do have time for another bottle. And then in walks Steve Georgiou.
Chapter 86. Donna has spent the evening looking through aeroplane passenger lists to and from Cyprus for the last 2 weeks. As if Gianni Gunders would be using his own name these days, but you never knew. Fun though the passenger lists had been, however, Donna is now back on Instagram. Toyota was history already, but Carl wouldn't wait around. Who was he seeing now? Donna was nothing if not a natural detective. Was he seeing that woman from his work? Poppy? Poppy, whose photo he'd liked on Facebook. Not just liked, but replied to with a wink emoji. Poppy, who seemed incapable of having her photo taken without being shot from the left and pouting. Yes, she was obvious enough for Carl. Donna had run her name through the Home Office computer on the off chance, but nothing. Donna knows it's time for bed, but she is still thinking about Penny Gray. After the Thursday Murder Club meeting, Elizabeth had told her she wanted her to meet someone and had led her into Willows, the nursing home attached to Cooper's Chase. They had walked down the quiet beige corridors with dim strip lighting and seaside watercolours lining the walls. It all carried an appalling weight, and the hopeful sprigs of flowers on cheap MDF side tables were powerless against it. Who brought the flowers in every day? That was a losing battle. But what was the alternative? Donna had gulped for air at one point. Willows was a prison from which no escape was possible, where release could only mean one thing. They had walked into the room and Elizabeth had said, Constable De Freitas, I'd like you to meet Detective Inspector Penny Gray. Penny had been lying in bed, a light sheet covering her to the neck, a blanket further down folded back, tubes running from her nose and from her wrists. Donna had once been on a school trip to the Lloyd's building, where everything that should be on the inside was on the outside. She preferred everything tidied away. Donna saluted.
Ma'am, take a seat, Donna. I thought it would be nice for the two of you to get to know each other. I do think you'll get along.
Elizabeth had taken Donna through Penny's career. Smart, resilient, opinionated, thwarted at every turn,
by her gender and by her temperament, or rather by the unacceptable combination of them both.
She's a wrecking ball, Elizabeth had said.
I'm a thin blade, you understand. Penny is all brute force. I don't know if you could tell that now. Donna looked at Penny and fancied that she could.
It was fashionable in the police back then, Elizabeth had gone on. A bit of blunt force. Fashionable if you were a man, at least. It never helped Penny. She never made it higher than Detective Inspector. Absurd if you knew her. I'm right, John. Absurd, wasn't it?
John had looked up and nodded. A waste.
She was trouble, Donna, said Elizabeth, and I can think of no finer compliment. That's why Penny enjoyed looking over the old cases. She could finally be in charge, could finally be the bull in a china shop. She didn't have to be polite and laugh at the jokes and make the tea.
Donna saw Elizabeth's hand close around Penny's. Elizabeth looked at her and nodded.
We fight on, though, don't we? Penny took it all, sucked it up, as they say, day after day without complaint.
She complained a lot. This was John. With respect, Elizabeth.
Well, yes, she had an impressive temper on her when she wanted to.
Very focused, John had agreed.
As they had left, generations apart, but shoulder to shoulder and in perfect step, Elizabeth had turned to Donna and said,
You will know better than me, Donna, but I think perhaps not all the battles have been won.
I think perhaps too, Donna had agreed. They had continued in companionable silence, out through the front doors of Willows, grateful to be breathing the air of the outside world.
Back at home, was this really home now? Donna is not fully concentrating on Instagram anymore. The visit to Penny has made her proud and sad. She would love to have met her, really met her. There are many reasons why Donna would like to be the one to crack these murders. And she adds making Detective Inspector Penny Gray proud to her list. Gianni for the Tony Curran murder. Matthew Mackey for Ventham. Elizabeth had told her to look into another of the residents. A Bernard Cottle. She had written the name down.
And the bones, are they important?
What do you say, Penny Gray?
It would be nice to wrap it all up. A nice tribute to someone who has gone before.
She should get back to those passenger lists.
Donna scrolls through some final pictures. Poppy has just been bungee jumping for cancer research.
Well, of course she has. That was so Poppy.
Chapter 87, Joyce. I don't often write in the morning, I know, but I am today. I just felt I should, so here I am. Yesterday was all very interesting, wasn't it? Those boys and all the murders and the drugs and what have you. I bet they had a lot to talk about when they headed off afterwards. I wonder who they were meeting. Really, it was very interesting to someone like me, very interesting. Gianni certainly sounds a likely culprit, doesn't he? I wonder if... Oh, stop it, Joyce, just stop it. You're putting it off. You don't want to write it. All right, then. So, I have had some sad news, and the sad news is this. I made my all's well call to Bernard this morning. Lots of people have an all's well arrangement. You buddy up with a pal, ring them at 8 a.m, let it ring twice and put the phone down. Then they do the same back. So you each know the other is okay without it costing you a penny. And of course, you don't have to have a conversation. So I rang Bernard this morning,
two rings, letting him know I was safe and sound. Hadn't had a fall or what have you. But nothing back. I never worry too much. Sometimes he forgets and I wander round and ring his buzzer and he shuffles to the window in his dressing gown and gives me a guilty thumbs up. I always think, oh, let me in, you silly old man. Let's have some breakfast. I don't mind the dressing gown, but that's not Bernard. So, over I trotted. Did I know? I suppose I did, but I also didn't, because it's too big a thing to know. But I suppose I did know, because Marjorie Walters saw me on my way over and said she'd waved, but I hadn't seen, just lost in a world of my own, which isn't like me. So yes, I suppose I knew. I buzzed and looked up at the window. The curtains were drawn. Perhaps he was asleep. Had a touch of flu and stayed in bed. Man flu, someone had said on This Morning the other day. It had tickled me and I told Joanna, but she said the expression had been around for years and had I really never heard it, which put me in my place. I'm stalling, I know. Let's get on to it. I let myself into the block with the spare key fob. I walked up the flight of stairs and saw an envelope sellotaped to Bernard's door. On the front of it, he had written, Joyce. Sorry. I have to finish there. There was even a smiley face in the O. You really never knew with Bernard. Chapter 88. Joyce opens up the envelope and slips out a handwritten letter, maybe 3 or 4 pages. She is grateful that her friends have come to her flat. She didn't want to go out there again today. So I'll just read it, not all of it, but the bits of interest. It answers a few questions we had. I know what some of you had been thinking about him. Maybe thought he'd, you know, Ian Ventham. Anyway. You take your time, says Ron, and places his hand on Joyce's for a moment. Joyce begins to read with an unfamiliar waver. Dear Joyce, I am sorry for the nuisance. Don't try to come in. I have bolted the door. First time I have used that bolt since I moved here. You will know what I have done, and I suppose it's nothing you haven't seen before 1,000 times. I will be lying in bed, all things being well, and perhaps I will look peaceful, but perhaps I won't. I would rather not take that chance, so I'll leave it to the ambulance men to decide if I look in a fit state for you to say goodbye. That's if you wish to say goodbye. Joyce stops reading for a moment. Elizabeth, Ron, and Ibrahim are completely silent. She looks up at them. They didn't let me see him in the end. I'm sure that's policy when you're not family. So he got that bit wrong, didn't he? And they were both ambulance women. Joyce gives a weak smile and her three friends mirror it. She continues reading. I have the pills by my side and I have a Laphroaig I had been saving for a rainy day. I see the lights turning off around me and it will be my turn next. Next to the bed are the beautiful flowers you bought me. They are in a milk bottle because you know me in vases. Before I go, I suppose I should tell you the whole thing. The whole thing? Says Elizabeth. Joyce puts a finger to her lips. Elizabeth does as she is told and Joyce continues reading Bernard's final letter. As you know, Asima, that's his wife,
died shortly after we moved to Cooper's Chase, which was a spanner in the works. I know you don't talk about Jerry very much, Joyce, but I know you understand. Like someone reached in and took out my heart and my lungs and told me to keep living, keep waking up, keep eating, keep putting one foot in front of the other. For what? I don't think I ever really found an answer to that. You know, I would often walk up the hill and sit on the bench Asima and I used to sit on when we first moved here, and you know I felt close to her there. But I had another reason for climbing that hill, a reason for which I feel profound shame, a shame that has become too much for me to bear. Joyce pauses for a moment. I wonder if I might have some water. Ron pours her a glass and hands it to her. Joyce drinks, then returns to the letter. You will know that many Hindus have their ashes scattered on the Ganges. These days, other rivers will do, but for a certain generation, it's still the Ganges, if you have the wherewithal. This was Asima's wish many, many years ago, certainly a wish that our daughter Sufi had grown up hearing about. Asima's funeral is not something I wish to think about or write about. But 2 days afterwards, Sufi and Majid, that's the daughter and son-in-law, flew to Varanasi in India and scattered Asima's ashes on the Ganges. But, Joyce, and here's where the pills and whiskey come in, I'm afraid. They weren't her ashes. She pauses and looks up.
Well, goodness,
says Ibrahim and sits forward as Joyce reads on. I am not a religious man, Joyce, as you are aware. But in her later years, Asima was not a religious woman either. She shook off her faith slowly, like the leaves from a tree, until nothing remained. I loved that woman with everything I possess, and she loved me. The thought of her leaving, being placed in hand luggage, Joyce, and then floating away from me, well, that wasn't something I was able to comprehend 2 days after saying goodbye. None of this excuses my actions, but I hope it might explain them. I had the ashes at home for the first night. Sufi and Majid weren't in my spare room. They had preferred to stay in a hotel, despite it all. Many years ago, Asima and I had been browsing at an old antique shop, and she had picked up a tea caddy in the shape of a tiger. Well, that's you, I said, and we both laughed. I called her Little Tiger, and she called me Big Tiger. You know the drill. I went back a week later to buy it for her as a surprise Christmas present, but it had already been sold. Anyway, that Christmas, I opened my present from her, and there it was. She had obviously gone straight back and bought it for me. I have kept it ever since. So, I took the urn and poured the ashes from the urn into the tiger tea caddy, then placed the caddy back in the cupboard. I filled the urn with a mixture of sawdust and bone meal. It's surprisingly convincing, then sealed it shut again. That's what Sufi took to Varanasi, and that's what she scattered on the Ganges. Bear in mind, I wasn't thinking straight, Joyce. I was paralysed with grief. I would have done anything to stop my Asima floating away. I had forgotten, of course, that she was Sufi's Asima too.
The next day, as soon after dark as I dared, I took a spade from the allotment shed and walked up the hill. I cut the turf from underneath the bench, I dug a hole, and I buried the tin. Even then, I knew it could only be temporary, but I wasn't ready to let her go. The turf settled back in. Nobody ever noticed a thing. Why would they? And every day I would go and sit on the bench, say hello when people walked by, and talk to Asima when they didn't. I knew then that it was wrong. I knew that I had betrayed my daughter and that I could never make amends. But the pain was so very great. Some people love their children more than they love their partner, says Ibrahim. And some people love their partner more than their children. And no one can ever admit either thing. Joyce nods absent-mindedly and begins a new page. The immediate pain goes, however much you might want it to stay, and I soon came to understand the enormity of what I had done. The awful selfishness, the entitlement. I started to think of plans and plots, something to put it right. Maybe I would dig the tea caddy up. I would take it on the bus down to Fairhaven, let some of her go and keep some of her with me. I could never tell Sufi what I had done, but at least her mother would be in the waves, returning to wherever Sufi imagines we return to. I knew it wasn't enough, but it was the best I could do. Until one morning, I climbed the hill to find workmen laying concrete foundation for the bench. They had dug down, not far enough to find the tin, and filled the hole with cement. They had the job done in half an hour. And that was that, I suppose. So silly when you look at it. But I had no easy way of digging the tea caddy back up. So I would continue to walk up the hill and continue to talk to Asima when no one was listening, telling her my news, telling her how much I loved her, and telling her I was sorry. And honestly, Joyce, for your eyes only, I realize that I have run out of whatever it is that we need to carry on. So, that's me, I'm afraid. Joyce finishes, stares down at the letter for another moment, running a finger across the ink. She looks up at her friends and attempts a smile, which turns in an instant to tears. The tears turn to shaking sobs, and Ron leaves his chair, kneels in front of her, and takes her in his arms. The thing Ron is so good at. Joyce buries her head in Ron's shoulder and flings her arms around him, weeping for Jerry and for Bernard and for Asima and for the ladies who went to Jersey Boys and drank G&Ts out of cans. All the way home.
Chapter 89. It is too late to be in Fairhaven Police Station, but Donna and Chris have nowhere else to be. Chris kneels and unblocks the paper jam in the photocopier. Chris finds it hard to kneel without cramping up these days. He isn't sure what that is. Too much salt or not enough salt? It's one or the other. Fixed it, he tells Donna. Donna presses print and makes a series of copies of the reports she's been sent by the Cypriot Police Service. I'll bind them all together for you, says Donna. It'll take a while, but it'll be easier for you. Very kind, Donna, says Chris. But you're still not coming to Cyprus with me. Donna sticks out her tongue. Chris has a very interesting interview lined up. One that should tell them once and for all where Gianni Gunders is.
Gianni's name has not appeared on any of the passenger lists that Donna had waded through. No flight, no boat, no train, either into or out of the UK. But Chris supposes that Gianni is unlikely to still be using his old name. Not when the police had been hunting him down for the murder of the young cabbie and Tony Curran had been hunting him down for the £100,000 he had stolen. But no one could simply disappear. There would be a trace somewhere. Chris shuts down his computer. He feels sure that Turkish Gianni is their man. He's been around long enough to sense when something fits perfectly. Evidence was another thing, but hopefully the trip to Nicosia will help him out there. Shall we call it a night? Quick drink, says Donna. Pont Noir. 6:50 flight in the morning, says Chris. Don't rub it in, says Donna. Chris stands and pulls down his office blinds. Gianni was one thing, but Ian Ventham? That was harder. Was it really connected to a murder from 50 years ago? Surely not. How many people could there be? Chris even had two DIs tracking down nuns in case they could remember anything. Surely some of them had left at some point, lost their calling and gone out into the real world. What would they be now? 80-odd? Records were sketchy, though, and he held out little hope. Or were they all missing something simpler? Don't crack the case while I'm gone, please.
I can't promise anything, says Donna.
Chris picks up his briefcase, time to go home. Always the worst time. Chris's dream life remains just one stone away. But in his briefcase there is a packet of salt and vinegar McCoy's, a Whisper and a Diet Coke. Diet Coke? Who did Chris think he was kidding? Sometimes Chris thinks he should join a dating website. In his mind, his perfect date would be a divorced teacher who had a small dog and sang in a choir. But he'd be happy to be proved wrong. Just someone kind and funny, really. Chris holds the door open for Donna, then follows her out. What kind of woman would want Chris? Did women really mind a bit of extra timber these days? Well, yes, he was sure they did, but even so. He was just about to solve a murder, and surely, somewhere in the whole of Kent, there was someone who might find that attractive. Chapter 90. Joyce. Oh, I can't sleep. It's Bernard, of course. I'm already wondering about the funeral. Will it be here? I do hope so. I know I hadn't known him long, but I'd hate to think of him in Vancouver. So I'm back here at 2 a.m. to give you some news. Don't worry. No one has died this time. After Ian, we had all been wondering what's to become of us here at Cooper's Chase. Who was going to take it over? I don't think anyone was too concerned. It seems to be profitable enough. So we knew there would be takers, but who? You can probably guess who found out. Elizabeth accidentally bumped into Gemma Ventham, Ian Ventham's unfortunate widow, yesterday at the new deli they've opened in Robertsbridge. It used to be Claire's hairdressers until Claire was struck off. Is struck off the correct expression for hairdressers? Either way, the local GP's wife lost the top of an ear, and that was that. They say Claire's in Brighton now, and that's probably for the best. Gemma was with a man who Elizabeth described as a tennis coach type, though conceded that these days he might have been a Pilates instructor type. Certainly not a grieving widow, and I think we all agreed that she'd earned a bit of happiness, so good for her. She has also, it seems, earned an awful lot of money. This is what Elizabeth got out of her. I don't know exactly how, but I do know that at one point she had pretended to faint because she had actually grazed her elbow in the effort. She always finds a way, that one. Anyway, Gemma